8. The urbanity, the culture, and the power of China under the early Tang rulers are in so vivid a contrast with the decay, disorder, and divisions of the Western world as at once to raise some of the most interesting questions in the history of civilization. Why didn't China keep this great lead she had won by her rapid return to unity and order? Why does she not, to this day, dominate the world culturally and politically?
For a long time, she certainly did keep ahead. It's only 1,000 years later, in the 16th and 17th centuries, with the discovery of America, the spread of printed books and education in the West, and the dawn of modern scientific discovery, that we can say with confidence that the Western world began to pull ahead of China. Under the Tang rule, her greatest period, and then again under the artistic but rather decadent Sung dynasty, 960 to 1279, and again during the period of the cultured Mings, 1358 to 1644, China presented a spectacle of prosperity, happiness, and artistic activity far in front of any contemporary state. And seeing that she achieved so much, why didn't she achieve more? Chinese shipping was upon the seas, and there was a considerable overseas trade during that time. Why did the Chinese never discover America or Australia? There was much isolated observation, ingenuity, and invention. The Chinese knew of gunpowder in the 6th century. They used coal and gas heating centuries before these things were used in Europe. Their bridge building, their hydraulic engineering, was admirable. The knowledge of materials shown in their enamel and lacquerware is very great. Why did they never organize the system of record and cooperation in inquiry that has given the world modern science? And why, in spite of their general training in good manners and self-restraint, did intellectual education never soak down into the general mass of the population? Why are the masses of China today, and why have they always been, in spite of an exceptionally high level of natural intelligence, illiterate? It's customary to meet such questions with rather platitudinous answers. We're told that the Chinaman is the most conservative of human beings, that in contrast with the European races his mind is twisted round towards the past, that he's the willing slave of etiquette and precedent to a degree inconceivable to Western minds. He's represented as having a mentality so distinct that one might almost expect to find a difference in brain structure to explain it. The appeals of Confucius to the wisdom of the ancients are always quoted to clinch this suggestion. If, however, we examine this generalization more closely, it dissolves into thin air. The superior intellectual initiative, the liberal enterprise, the experimental disposition that's supposed to characterize the Western mind is manifest in the history of that mind only during certain phases and under exceptional circumstances. For the rest, the Western world displays itself as traditional and conservative as China. And, on the other hand, the Chinese mind has, under conditions of stimulus, shown itself quite as inventive and versatile as the European, and the very kindred Japanese mind even more so. For take the case of the Greeks. The whole swing of their mental vigor falls into the period between the 6th century BC and the decay of the Alexandrian Museum under the later Ptolemies in the 2nd century BC. There were Greeks before that time and Greeks since, but a history of 1,000 years of the Byzantine Empire showed the Hellenic world at least as intellectually stagnant as China. Then we have already drawn attention to the comparative sterility of the Italian mind during the Roman period and its abundant fertility since the Renaissance of learning. The English mind again had a phase of brightness in the 7th and 8th centuries, and it didn't shine again until the 15th. Again, the mind of the Arabs, as we shall presently tell, blazed out like a star for half a dozen generations after the appearance of Islam, having never achieved anything of importance before or since. On the other hand, there was always a great deal of scattered inventiveness in China, and the progress of Chinese art witnesses to new movements and vigorous innovations. We exaggerate the reverence of the Chinese for their fathers, Parricide was a far commoner crime among the Chinese emperors than it was even among the rulers of Persia. Moreover, there have been several liberalizing movements in China, several recorded struggles against the ancient ways. It's already been suggested that phases of real intellectual progress in any community seem to be connected with the existence of a detached class of men sufficiently free not to be obliged to toil or worry exhaustively about mundane needs, and not rich and powerful enough to be tempted into extravagances of lust, display, or cruelty. They must have a sense of security, but not a conceit of superiority. This class, we further insinuated, must be able to talk freely and communicate easily. It mustn't be watched for heresy or persecuted for any ideas it may express. Such a happy state of affairs certainly prevailed in Greece during its best days. A class of intelligent, free, gentlefolk is indeed evident in history whenever there is a record of bold philosophy or effective scientific advances. In the days of T'ang and Sung and Ming, there must have been an abundance of pleasantly circumstanced people in China, of just the class that supplied most of the young men of the Academy at Athens, or the bright intelligences of Renaissance Italy, or the members of the London Royal Society, that mother society of modern science. And yet China didn't produce in these periods of opportunity any such large beginnings of recorded and analyzed fact. If we reject the idea that there is some profound racial difference between China and the West, which makes the Chinese by nature conservative and the West by nature progressive, then we're forced to look for the operating cause of this difference in progressiveness in some other direction. Many people are disposed to find that operating cause, which has, in spite of her original advantages, retarded China so greatly during the last 4 or 5 centuries, in the imprisonment of the Chinese mind in a script and in an idiom of thought so elaborate and so difficult that the mental energy of the country has been largely consumed in acquiring it. This view deserves examination. We've already given an account in Chapter 16, of the peculiarities of Chinese writing and of the Chinese language. The Japanese writing is derived from the Chinese and consists of a more rapidly written system of forms. A great number of these forms are ideograms, taken over from the Chinese and used exactly as the Chinese ideograms are used, but also a number of signs are used to express syllables. There's a Japanese syllabary after the fashion of the Sumerian syllabary we have described in Chapter 16. The Japanese writing remains a clumsy system, as clumsy as cuneiform, though not so clumsy as Chinese, and there's been a movement in Japan to adopt a Western alphabet. Korea, long ago, went a step farther and developed a true alphabet from the same Chinese origins. With these exceptions, all the great writing systems now in use in the world are based on the Mediterranean alphabets and are beyond comparison more easily learnt and mastered than the Chinese. This means that while other peoples learn merely a comparatively simple and straightforward method of setting down the language with which they are familiar, the Chinaman has to master a great multitude of complex word signs and word groups. He mustn't simply learn the signs, but the established grouping of those signs to represent various meanings. He must familiarize himself, therefore, with a number of exemplary classical works. Consequently, in China, while you'll find great numbers of people who know the significance of certain frequent and familiar characters, you discover only a few whose knowledge is sufficiently extensive to grasp the meaning of a newspaper paragraph, and still fewer who can read any subtlety of intention or fine shades of meaning. In a lesser degree, this is true also of Japan. No doubt European readers, especially of such word-rich languages as English or Russian, vary greatly among themselves in regard to the extent of books they can understand and how far they understand them. Their power varies according to their vocabularies, but the corresponding levels of understanding among the Chinese represent a far greater expenditure of time and labor upon their attainment. A Mandarin's education in China is, mainly, learning to read.